a lot of the fashion brands that have been saying, you know, we want to invest in novel fibers, we want to invest in fiber to fiber recycling technology, are then not actually putting their money where their mouth is. And that's having a tangible effect on a lot of these, you know, recycling businesses, or a lot of these kind of solutions. I don't think it will last. I think it's a blip. It's unfortunate. And I think it's something that also we need the power of policy within there.
Welcome to the 18th episode of the Kiwi Podcast Season 2. In this episode, we have with us George Harding Rhodes, the Director of Policy and Advocacy at EcoAge. He runs the organization's work on pushing for the equitable phase out of fossil fuel from fashion. Previously, he was with the Changing Markets Foundation, a Dutch non-profit formed to accelerate solutions to sustainability challenges by leveraging the power of markets, where he ran several hard-hitting corporate investigations pushing for accountability and advocating for legislative change. In this episode, we speak with him about his active involvement in environmental advocacy in his career, about his new impactful role at EcoAge, and how the organization is addressing some of the most pressing issues we are facing today in the fashion industry. We also speak with him about his key role in launching the Fossil Fashion Campaign, how it has affected the public awareness of fossil fuel dependence, and his thoughts on how small brands with limited resources can look to be more sustainable. We look forward to you tuning into this very, very insightful discussion. Thank you so much, George, for having this conversation with us today. I'm very excited to talk about EcoAge and the work that EcoAge is doing, and also one of the campaigns that you recently launched as well. But to begin with, can you tell us a little bit about your background and how you became actively involved in environmental advocacy, particularly in the fashion industry?
Yeah, sure. So I've been working in this space for about 10 years or so from a variety of different angles, different perspectives. Obviously working at EcoAge at the moment, which is a business, but I've been working predominantly in the civil society space for the last 10 years for a number of different NGOs. I kind of cut my teeth in the sustainability space actually when I was living out in Beijing, and I was working for a human rights lawyer out there as a kind of glorified PA, really, kind of following her around, going on to a lot of meetings in the sort of diplomatic space. And yeah, just really getting a sense of more how businesses were operating in that context, because specifically in China, that was about your license to operate within the country was predicated on your ability to help the government with certain social and environmental issues at that moment in time. It may not be the case now. So I knew that I wanted to get into the sustainability space whilst, you know, this was in my early 20s. Whilst a lot of my friends were going into kind of more traditional routes, traditional careers. Sustainability now is obviously a very valid career, and a lot of people trying to get into it, but 10 years ago, not so much. So I started working at an NGO called Forum for the Future, which is a big international nonprofit that really works to push businesses forward on critical missions around food, energy, climate, etc. I worked there for about 4.5 years or so. And then moved on to a job at the Changing Markets Foundation, which is a campaigning organization working on corporate accountability around key issues. And I kind of ended up in the fashion. I'd worked across fashion projects for a while at both jobs, but I kind of got into the core of the fashion sustainability movement and campaigning side kind of by accident, because through the plastics side. So I was working on a campaign on plastics, and then we were suddenly coming across this whole other area of petrochemical production, of plastics production, that wasn't really being talked about in terms of synthetic fibers, plastic fibers like polyester, polyamide, acrylics, that sort of stuff. And we just decided to run this camp, to set up this campaign on that, which we ran for about 3 years or so, really highlighting this intrinsic link between fast fashion and its over-reliance on fossil fuel derived materials. And then now I'm working at EcoAge. So come full circle back to working at a business again.
Yeah. No, so you recently became the director of policy and advocacy at EcoRage. Tell us a little bit more about the role that you have currently and what you plan to do with it.
Sure. I mean, it felt like the opportunity of a lifetime when Livia approached me with the role, because I'd literally been chatting with one of the team in a really over lunch and saying, oh, you know, I've always thought EcoRage is a fascinating business because it's this really hybrid organization. Obviously, it works with businesses, with progressive businesses, to help them on their various different sustainability challenges and communications. But it's also had a very long history of activism and advocacy, whether that's the organization itself or Livia as the kind of figurehead. So yeah, I was talking about how I'd love to come in and work with those businesses on pushing forward their advocacy agenda. So getting them to be more politically active on sustainability issues, because that can be what helps ambitious legislation to get across the line. And then they turn around and offer me a job, so that's fantastic. So really the role speaks to that. I mean, between the policy side and the advocacy side, so the policy side, within the fashion context, that we're facing this tidal wave of legislation, of regulation coming down the pipeline, whether it's in North America, in Europe, further afield in terms of due diligence legislation, and a lot of businesses in the fashion space are struggling to work out what that will mean for them. And then particularly, you know, they're focusing on compliance and they're not thinking about how they can take a leadership position on that legislation to make sure it's ambitious and well implemented. So part of my role is on that, working with existing businesses and new clients on how to interpret the shifting regulatory landscape. And then the more on the advocacy side, it's about what EcoAge is wanting to work on as an activist advocacy organization. So for initially, that looks like our fossil fuel fashion campaign, which we launched at New York Climate Week, which builds on several years of research from NGO partners, including the Changing Markets Foundation, looking into this issue of over-reliance on fossil fuels within the fashion industry, not only on the materials, fossil fuel-based materials side, so plastic fibers, but then also within the supply chain emissions. And then even further beyond that, looking at support of systemic legislation that kind of speaks to that lobbying and advocacy side of things.
Mm-hmm. I definitely want to talk more about the campaign. But before we get into that a little bit more, I'd love to hear about the work that EcoAge has done all these years. Like you mentioned, they've been a really powerful company in the sustainability space for a while now. And all of us small businesses definitely look up to EcoAge for the voice that they are. I'd love to hear more about some of the notable projects or initiatives that they've done that, you know, has really made an impact on the fashion industry.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, bearing in mind I'm relatively new, I think my perspective on it is similar to yours, that I've always looked up to them as an organization. They've always been on my radar as treading that line between being a business that works with other businesses in a kind of consultancy model, but then also taking strong stances. So I think some of the stuff around like the Fashionscape series of documentaries, that was really pioneering work that we've done, for example, with, I'm trying to think, well, with the Green Carpet Fashion Awards, mm-hmm. That's a relatively new project that I think is really kind of leading the space in identifying who are the kind of movers and shakers in the sustainability world. And then honestly, I think just the day-to-day behind the scenes work of pushing the businesses, pushing clients to be better, to be more ambitious, to not think of it as sustainability as usual, and actually to think of this as like the opportunity to differentiate yourself as a business, but also to push the agenda forward in terms of sustainability. And a lot of similar businesses, similar agencies won't do that with clients. They're looking to kind of meet the client's needs, meet what they're asking for, help them sort out the problems they're facing, but not to push them further. And even to fire clients. I mean, Livia talks about it quite a lot, about how we fired clients in the past because they're not meeting our standards. And, you know, we don't want to be involved with any business that's not going to be progressive in the way that in the worldview that we want to align with.
Mm-hmm. I would assume that there were a lot of companies initially that would require pitching to, right? And now I'm sure there are a lot of companies approaching EcoAge with their difficulties in how to make those changes. What does it feel like from just to kind of get a feel for what the industry is like at this point? I know from when we began EcoAge in 2015, and so much has changed since then. But what does it feel like from an industry point of view? Are more companies actually making progress in the way that they are functioning as companies?
So what's changed, certainly in the last 10 years that I've been in the sector, is rather than outsourcing your sustainability onto a company like EcoAge or an equivalent agency, particularly when it comes to sustainability communications and strategy, many companies have teams within the organization, internal teams who are across that, whether that's data collection or compliant communications, etc. So really the need to outsource that has slightly diminished, and so we spend a lot of time on training side of things, skilling up those kind of teams. But then also that's why it's so critical and I think visionary that EcoAge has set up this policy division. I mean, without sort of being wanting to blow my own trumpet here, because I am heading up that division, but I think them taking a punt and taking a bit of a risk actually in setting up this department, recognizing this is what the industry needs, but it doesn't necessarily know that it needs yet. So the work is still pitching that to clients, to prospective new business. And I think what we are seeing as well is that's being responded to. We've had quite a few interesting conversations over the last couple of months fashion brands coming in and being like, we need to make sense of this whole thing that's happening to the industry that's happened very, very quickly over the last 2 years. You know, you've had people pushing for proper legislation in the fashion industry, particularly in Europe, for many, many years. And then suddenly now it's here. It's like you've got to interpret what that actually means for you. So I think things are shifting and evolving in the industry all the time. But I think that would be my main distinction, that it's gone from the challenge has changed. It's about getting your shop front in order in terms of your supply chain, in terms of your communications on sustainability. And now it's like, how do you comply with all these new rules and regulations on the industry and take a leadership position to make sure that they're ambitiously implemented?
Mm-hmm. What do you feel are some of the opportunities and challenges that you're anticipating from this, not just this role, but this department that you are in or leading at EcoAge?
I think it's in having a vision of what the future fashion system has to look like. And it's not even a kind of idealistic, like this is what we would like it to look like. This is what a fashion system that exists within planetary boundaries and is respectful of social justice and includes a fair phase out of fossil fuels. This is what that system needs to look like. What are the policies and legislation in place? What are the kind of brands that should be green-lighted by that policy? By those policies or by investors, what are the solutions in place? What kind of materials and systems of circularity we are looking at within that? And I think with an organization like EcoAge trying to hold that vision or trying to be imaginative and creative about that vision and presenting it back to the industry or to policymakers, I think that's a huge opportunity to kind of get our ducks in a row on that side. And we are, with the fossil fuel fashion campaign and then also with our work with businesses. And I think it's helping businesses as well to be imaginative about that future system and not just firefight existing problems and actually start to, sow the seeds of that future system and take action rather than, despair all the time, because it's easy to fall into despair.
Yeah.
Not going in a good way. And there's a lot of backsliding on corporate commissions. There's a lot of undermining of legislation, so it's a constant battle, one that I think you have to think of as being I always call it a bun fight. Don't know if you have that term, but like it's almost like a food fight. It's a sort of everybody's fighting each other. There's a lot of fighting in the sustainability world, but you've got to think of it as fun. You've got to think of it as the way that ideas are built up and made realistic, otherwise you'll lose your mind.
Yeah. No, I love that. Can you share with us And maybe we can even talk about the fossil fashion campaign now, but like, can you share with us what that future system looks like? Can you paint some kind of a general picture of what that could look like if we're able to actually get these legislations going and, you know, it works in that direction?
Yeah. So if we look at what the legislative trajectory is telling us of what that system could look like, and it's all quite hazy because different pieces of legislation are at different stages. The EU essentially has said that they want fast fashion to be out of fashion. So if that is given full credence and it is followed through to its full ambition, then we are looking at a system where the likes of Shein can no longer exist. They no longer have a license to operate. They are no longer compliant. And so what we're looking at then is a much more conscious consumption of fashion. The fashion itself, what we would like and what the trajectory is in terms of global calls for fossil fuel phase out, the clothing itself much less reliant on fossil fuels where possible given timeframes, whether that's in the materials themselves or in supply chains, you know, how clothes are produced, how the manufacturing of clothes is powered, which is broadly by fossil fuels at the moment. And I think this is where it kind of blurs over into my vision, EcoAge's vision of what that future system needs to look like. And we can't talk about that without talking about degrowth and without talking about overproduction. And it's a difficult conversation to have. And it's a conversation that has to take into account a just transition as well. But we just cannot keep on with the current trajectory of the fashion system. So any future vision of a fashion system has to be I hate to say curtailed, because I don't think we should think of it as a restrictive policy. I think we should think of it as a flourishing in different ways, finding new ways to create value without overreaching planetary boundaries. I was having an interesting conversation earlier today about, particularly on our fossil fuel phase out, fair fossil fuel phase out from the fashion industry, if that's enough Fs for you, what that would need to be like in terms of materials. And actually, so our calls to action within the campaign, just on the material side, not on the supply chain side, are a 20% reduction of fossil fuel derived materials by 2025 and a 50% reduction by 2030. And there are actually a couple of brands who are, you know, committing to that at the moment, which is great. But what that actually means, like, if you projected that out onto the entire industry and what their materials profile would look like, it would actually mean reducing synthetics to about the levels that they were in the 1990s, which is not an unreasonable level. Back in the 1990s, if listeners were alive, I was alive.
Yeah.
You know, we had clothes to wear. We had, you know, industry flourishing. We had clothes to wear. We weren't getting wet when we went outside. You know, we had shoes on our feet. And what's happened in between now and then is that per capita consumption of clothing has skyrocketed way beyond proportion with global population growth. It's got much cheaper as a proportion of household income. And that growth is largely accounted for by the rise of fibers like polyester. So this is why we are looking specifically at the fossil fuel-based materials part of it, because we see that as being the engine of growth for fast fashion and something that needs to be addressed within a future system, or addressed now so that the future system isn't heavily reliant on fossil fuels still.
I definitely want to understand what the reliance is of fossil fuel in the fashion industry, but I also want to kind of talk about how Shein, for example, needs to just shut down. And how is that even going to happen? Or how is the fast fashion industry just going to kind of come to a close? So how is that even going to happen? Like, how are consumers... So if I just randomly talk about it, I feel like consumers are so dependent on it. How much ever we educate and create awareness about the ill effects of fast fashion and the impact it has on the environment and its people, people are still hooked. So how are we going to stop them from consuming? So many people stop them from consuming. Or should we just shut down these fast fashion companies? And if that happens, how does that even happen?
Right. I mean, it feels kind of like an intractable problem, you know, particularly when you think of our ongoing reliance on fast fashion and the rise of these massive ultra fast fashion brands that you know, but I long for the days back in the past when H&M looked like the biggest problem in the room, and now you've got Boohoo, Shein, Pretty Little Thing, Temu, all these ultra fast fashion brands. And I think what's changed is the legislation piece. So I liken it to a game of Monopoly. You can play the game of Monopoly over and over and over again with as many variations as possible, with as many different levels of altruism within the players as possible. But fundamentally, the rules of the game are rigged towards there being a monopoly at the end of it. And that's within the fashion sector and actually the sustainability sector more broadly, what we've seen over the last like 20 to 30 years since it's been a key focus, or maybe even 10 years, to be honest, is us putting it on the players to change the rules of the game in a way that they're simply not going to do. There's another analogy that a guy called Tariq Fancy, who used to be the head of sustainable investing at BlackRock and then kind of went a bit vigilante on them and has been exposing some of the hoax around ESG. And he likens it to a game of basketball and relying on the players to self-police themselves through good sportsmanship rather than relying on the referee or the umpire, whatever it is in basketball, to implement rules, or on the governing body of the game to change the rules. So broadly saying, that's why it's about, you know, rule change is about legislation change. And that's only relatively recently happened within the fashion industry. We know we can't really put it all on consumers to change their consumption patterns without that coming from businesses and how they change their marketing practices, or how they move away from a trend-led model, or invest in the infrastructure that we need in order to, you know, transition to a circular fashion system. So to take an example, fiber-to-fiber recycling doesn't really exist. It's probably about 1% of the end of life of apparel and footwear at the moment. And a large part of that is technological immaturity, which is due to chronic underinvestment, as well as just, you know, the technology is not really being there yet. And part of it is also to do with infrastructure. Both of those need a huge amount of investment. They need investment from fashion companies themselves, whether that's the big multinationals or smaller companies. They need policy green lights. So recently there was a piece of legislation in the EU dealing with sort of repair and reuse, but it didn't include targets. Repair, reuse and recycle didn't include targets, which is that's not a particularly strong signal to the industry that this is something that's got legs, that needs lots of investment. So yeah, chronic underinvestment over the years from, both the financial sector as well as companies themselves. And, you know, part of the work that I did at Changing Markets, the work we did on plastics, is we looked at the ways that companies will undermine progress that would affect their bottom line. Essentially, these are big consumer companies like Coca-Cola, etc. And we got all their different tactics from a whole load of different case studies around the world, 10 different countries around the world, and we compiled them into different categories as to what this undermining progress looks like. And we call it delay, distract, derail. And one of the key ways they do that is to put the blame onto consumers and say, consumers are not demanding it. Consumers are the ones that need to change. And they create demand. Brands create demand themselves. Brands also either create environments that are conducive to infrastructure that we need for circularity, or infrastructure we need to change our consumption patterns, or they perpetuate it. So I think this is not to take, ultimately the goal is behavior change for sure, but it's not going to happen overnight from a consumer just waking up and decide they want to be eco-conscious, because the whole system is rigged against them. Billions and billions and billions of dollars are plowed every day into making you buy that new item online, or making you believe that your current wardrobe is out of trend and you want to throw it out. And very little attention and very little money is put in return into changing the rules of the game. So we hold on to our fashion for longer. We, you know, have systems in place to repair, reuse, recycle it. That's valued within society. I could go on. But yes, short answer, it's got to be policy change.
Yeah. No, and also if the big guns are leading the way in terms of how we even think as individuals, right? Mm-hmm. Like, And I remember talking about this earlier in one of the episodes as well, where we talk about how with Instagram, for example, where we're taking selfies and putting it up on Instagram, and then we don't want to repeat an outfit. I'm not saying me, but like in general, people don't want to repeat outfits at parties or events. You're kind of told to do that by the big companies. So it's kind of like ingrained in our mindsets already that this is the way we need to think and this is the way we need to consume. So that change, I feel, is going to be huge. But I think, like you said, the behavioral change is something that is what is going to change things for us.
And I think that's really difficult one as well when you're talking about like marketing practices and you're talking about like cultural elements, which vary depending on what like background you're from, which country you live in, you know, talking just about like whether you need a new outfit for this or a new outfit for that, that changes across different cultural identities. And that's hard to regulate as well. That's hard to legislate. That's more of a kind of a slow consciousness over time. You know, it's one of those things that, what's can be frustrating about working in the climate space is knowing that had we taken incremental change 20 years ago, the level of difference and the level of discomfort that we would be feeling would be relatively minimal, because you're talking about a percentage point year on year on year, like a percentage reduction in fossil fuel reliance year on year on year, rather than now what we've got to do is a practically instantaneous system shift over to an entirely new way of thinking, of getting around, of eating, etc. And I think that speaks volumes to the fashion side of things in terms of consumption patterns, behaviors, attitudes, trends. These sort of cultural shifts take a really, really long time to change, and they take constant attention. It's not something that there's any silver bullet solution to. It's not something that sits with one brand or one group of companies. Mm-hmm. It's not even something that sits within one like jurisdiction in terms of policy. So I think that's one that's going to take a long time to come.
Yeah. So can you tell us a little bit about the fossil fashion campaign and what that relation is with fossil fuels and the fashion industry?
Yeah, so it's a body of work that we began to work on at the Changing Markets Foundation. They're still active in that space. And a lot of the work that they do is around it's campaigning, but it's investigations and research and really kind of compiling the case for action, building up that body of evidence alongside many other NGOs like Fashion Revolution, Stand Earth, Plastic Suit Foundation, etc. And then in joining EcoAge, there was the opportunity to really take it up a level in terms of an awareness raising campaign, in terms of advocacy and policy making. And the primary ambition really is that the climate movement is quite unaware of the role of fashion in fossil fuels, and a role of fashion in fossil fuel phase out. You cannot phase out of fossil fuels on a global scale without tackling the fashion industry, because a vast amount of fossil fuels, petrochemicals, go into making plastics and synthetic fibers. There was analysis done a couple of years ago that suggested between 45 and 95% of future growth in oil demand will come from plastics and synthetics. So this is the cash cow of the fossil fuel industry. To the extent that even the president of COP28 in the UAE, who is an oil man, was saying that when challenged on the build out of fossil fuel capacity that they're undergoing in the UAE at the moment, he said, well, it's fine, because if we don't end up using it for energy and transport, we can always turn it into plastic and synthetic fibers. So it is literally it's the future revenue stream. It's the pressure release valve for the fossil fuel industry, which is facing a big problem of kind of stranded assets in the future. So all that to say, we think it is so vital to get this conversation on fossil fuel reliance in the fashion industry into the climate space in a way that it's not been so far. It's been in the fashion space, but not the climate space. So we launched this campaign, based on research done by many NGOs and with many NGO partners, at Climate Week in New York. We then had a series of activations as well to kind of embed it into conversations around the world. So we'll be out in COP. Last week, we were in Brussels hosting a roundtable with policymakers there on what's the EU's role in phasing out fossil fuels from fashion. We're doing a follow-up event in Brussels next month, looking specifically at a piece of regulation on eco-design. So how do you make sustainable products? And really to make sure we have this rallying cry ahead of COP28 and beyond of a fair phase out of fossil fuels from fashion, within materials, within supply chains and beyond. And yeah, that's been my life for the last 3 years and my life for the last 2 months with EcoAge. And we're getting some really positive traction, really, really great cut through with policymakers, with activists, with fashion brands. And I think speaking to what we were talking about earlier in the conversation about solutions, what we're seeing now that we weren't seeing 3 years ago is solutions waiting in the wings, whether that's brands looking to commit to phasing out fossil fuel derived fibers, or committing to reductions in supply chain emissions, or whether it's the kind of novel alternative materials that are really abounding now, things made from agricultural waste, cellulosic fibers made from agricultural waste, fibers which have the properties and the strength and performance of synthetics, but are fully recyclable, fully biodegradable. Brands who are committing to, we're working with a sports brand called Mover, which does 100% plastic-free sportswear. So they're really kind of pushing forward on undermining some of these myths that have been perpetuated by the fashion industry around their need to continue to reliance on plastic materials, So, they say, well, we need them because people need to hike to the highest mountains in our clothing. And then you've got a brand like Mover saying like, but you can do that with, you can do that without plastic. And with that you get breathability and you get less chemicals and less kind of harmful substances in it. So I think that's what I was speaking to earlier about a future system kind of waiting in the wings that we need to usher in that actually looks much more positive, much better for human health, much better for planetary health.
Thank you for listening to the Ikibi podcast. If you are enjoying listening to our podcast, do consider supporting us by visiting www.ikibi.com. That is IKKIVI.com. We are a small sustainable business supporting contemporary Indian brands. Our platform is run by an all-women team handpicking the most beautiful, ethically made clothes and accessories from across the country, all in one place. Our podcast is self-funded and will always be free to listen to. You supporting our work would mean a lot to us. Thank you for being here, and let's get back to our episode.
What is the access like for materials like this for brands in general, not just in EU but like world over? Is it easily accessible? Do you see it becoming more popular now with a lot more brands, kind of agreeing to get rid of fossil fuels completely in their supply chain?
So I think there's two parts of it. First is that it's not a kind of naturals versus synthetics debate. Although we're focusing quite heavily on fossil fuel derived materials, the idea is not that you replace them lock, stock and barrel for naturals, because obviously there's a lot of problems with natural fibers like cotton in terms of pesticide and fertilizer use, wool in terms of, animal agriculture. That's why I think some of these novel materials are really interesting, because they're much lower impact than what we traditionally rely upon. In terms of access, it's a really interesting question. I think it speaks to that chronic underinvestment that we're seeing in while they can continue relying on what they're relying on now, why would you invest a lot into a new system? Underinvestment element. That these are companies that need to build out infrastructure, build out capacity. And for that, they need not only investment from the financial community, but also from brands. They need orders from brands in order to actually build out.
Yeah.
And I think there was an interesting point, article I read yesterday about Renewcell, who are a big textile recycler, fiber-to-fiber recycler of cellulosic fibers, so things like cotton, jeans, that sort of thing, who have experienced a sharp drop in share price because they've had to sell off a lot of stock because they're simply not getting in the orders that they had predicted they would. So a lot of the fashion brands that have been saying, we want to invest in novel fibers, we want to invest in fiber-to-fiber recycling technology, are then not actually putting their money where their mouth is. And that's having a tangible effect on a lot of these, recycling businesses or a lot of these kind of solutions. I don't think it will last. I think it's a blip. It's unfortunate. And I think it's something that could also, we need the power of policy within there. You know, I was talking earlier about the lack of targets within things like the Waste Framework Directive in the EU. And if you start to put targets in place, I mean, the rationale for not putting targets in place was immaturity of technology, but actually that kind of creates a self-fulfilling prophecy, because if you don't put targets in place, you don't give a kind of clear trajectory as to where the industry is going, and then a clear rationale to invest, or a clear signal to brands that this is something they need to be heavily pursuing.
Mm-hmm. What do you feel, you were saying earlier about the switch between you know, synthetic versus, you know, natural fibers. What does that actually look like if we're not, of course, just completely stopping all synthetic fibers and just moving to natural fibers? What does that actually look like then? Like, what is that balance? Is there a balance? Or is it these novel fabrics that need to come into the equation for us to actually have a more, you know, sustainable use of fabrics?
Yeah, I think we need to, as a first point, we need to sort of systematically undermine a lot of the arguments that it allow us to kind of continue our heavy reliance on fossil fuel derived materials, on synthetics. So, you know, one of them, for example, is durability. And it's a really interesting one to unpack, because whether it's an outdoor brand talking about performance, or whether it's even a fast fashion brand justifying the use of polyester because it lasts for a really long time, because it doesn't degrade. We know it doesn't biodegrade because we see the problem in places like Hantamanto Market, or in Gikomba Market in Nairobi, you know, Tandora dump site, which is full of synthetic clothing waste. And there was a very interesting discussion we were having in Brussels the other day with some researchers at Oslo Metropolitan University, who've done a really authoritative study looking at durability in terms of emotional durability versus physical durability. And one of their key findings is it was essentially that people don't throw out clothing because it is worn out, very rarely. They throw out clothing because it's out of fashion, because they don't have an emotional connection with it anymore, because they wanted to buy something new. They wanted to replace it with something new. And I think when you look at clothing sustainability then from an emotional durability perspective, and then if you are looking at a lifetime and durability side of things from a physical perspective, you're looking at it from a usage perspective. So how I think this is a really interesting way to look at things, like the single most sustainable thing you can do with your existing clothes is to wear them more. You know, your impact per wear is a really interesting metric to look at clothing, and you reduce the impact of that, what, you know, the resources and the energy that went to make that item of clothing, the more you wear it, you know, it diminishes over time. So yeah, it kind of speaks to that point earlier about a cultural shift that's needed in terms of shifting away from this take, make, waste model of clothing and more to something that's a bit more conscious, that still creates value for people. And I think the fiber-to-fiber recycling technologies and circularity and reuse and repair, those are also glimmers of a future system, you know, waiting in the wings, where we can create value for people, we can create jobs for people, we can create kind of a flourishing economy within a circular fashion system, rather than just continuing to think in a very blinkered, very linear model that is entirely wired to fossil fuel derived materials and fossil fuels within the supply chain to power it.
Mm-hmm. What can I know we're talking about fossil fuels specifically, but like in general, what can smaller brands, because a lot of the brands that we showcase as well on Ikivi, and the brands that we interact with are all independent and small brands, and all of them have the intention of wanting to be more sustainable and ethical in their supply chain. And they try with every collection going forward. What are some of the steps you think that they can take to, you know, make that change? Because with the limited resources and, you know, finances that they have, and like you said earlier, you do require the investment for technology and for a variety of other things, and, you know, access to these fabrics and new fibers. What do you think smaller brands can actually do to make some change?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's about thinking big, thinking about rule change, you know, changing the rules of the system in any small part that you can. You know, each of us individually, whether or not we own a business or not, have a voice as active citizens in calling for system change. And I think you have even more of a voice as an owner of a small brand. It all counts. It, you know, when you take it into a kind of political context in policy deliberations, in whether that's North America, EU, or on other pieces of legislation around the world, it might not even be about materials. It might be about green claims, that sort of thing. I think raising your voice and becoming politically more active, that doesn't need to be in a consumer facing way. You know, you don't need to be bombarding your customers with your own like advocacy. In that sense, you can do that, but I think in my experience, what I've seen can really tip the balance in favor of ambitious environmental legislation versus regressive or watered down legislation is the presence of industry voices calling for change. And that can be small brands as well. And I think in many ways, particularly when it comes to green claims, and because I've done a lot of work on greenwashing, a lot of like speaking about greenwashing, and I think actually the best ones to learn from are the small brands. You know, they're the ones with authentic voices. They're the ones who really know their supply chain. It's often the founder who will actually know the supply chain themselves because they've had to do the legwork at the beginning and like, you know, challenge you to find a single CEO of a major fashion brand who knows the ins and outs of their supply chain like a small brand would. So they have a lot to teach us in terms of like having an authentic story on green claims and green sustainability communication, as well as then, you know, taking those learnings, taking that insight into the kind of policy and legislation space.
Very recently, I heard somebody telling us about how the perception of sustainability in fashion is kind of, earlier it used to be, and I'm sure it's also because of greenwashing, the perception is that currently is that everybody is sustainable. Like, you know, everybody is saying that they are sustainable in some way or the other. And we're so done hearing that from brands. Like, that's what we've started hearing. And that kind of came as a shock because we initially started off with creating awareness. And it's a great thing because everybody is now talking about sustainability and what that means in the fashion industry. But I feel like there is some level of, I don't know if fatigue is the right word from a consumer point of view, but like, I feel like there is that like dullness. Also, I think maybe post-COVID, everybody wants like, doesn't want to like talk about things that are sad and upsetting. And there's so much rubbish going around in the world or happening in the world that everybody wants something to kind of boost themselves up. Do you feel like this perception kind of exists, or is it something that is an anomaly?
Yeah, I think to your point around green claims and greenwashing and yeah, certainly that I think I've described it before as consumers being lost in a sea of green claims. Not now so much, but certainly a year or 2 years ago. And that was like peak greenwashing era. Mm-hmm. Interesting period to live through, and anyone working in this space. And I think, you know, to speak to the greenwashing part, it makes so much sense that greenwashing existed as a phenomenon, and it has existed for a long time, but in that peak greenwashing era, because, you know, we were like sitting ducks as consumers. We started to grow our awareness of sustainability, started to get, you know, very concerned about the environment. We obviously had the rise of things like Extinction Rebellion, Fridays for Future, you know, a huge headwind of positive attitudes towards making a change in terms of climate change. And yeah, that was absolute catnip to brands saying, we can make you believe that you're making a change to the planet and get your money by selling you products that are marketed as sustainable, even if that's not substantiated and even if it's misleading and not the whole picture. And that led to this period of this huge green bubble, this period of greenwashing, particularly in the fashion industry. And I think the fashion industry is one of the most evident, one of the worst in terms of culprits. And then I spent a lot of time working working on like why, how to articulate why greenwashing is bad and why it needs to be cracked down upon, and working in the UK with the Competition and Markets Authority, you know, feeding them research and, you know, having conversations with them about their, you know, interpretation of consumer law or competition law when it comes to green claims. Because on the crackdown on greenwashing from a regulatory perspective, a lot of it is just an interpretation of existing consumer protection law or competition law within the context of sustainability claims. Not to go on too much of a tangent on it, but yeah, essentially greenwashing in the round, it acts as a giant societal placebo, and, you know, makes us think that we've been making a lot of progress on sustainability in the fashion sector when actually we haven't, and most of those claims have been unsubstantiated. So I think, to your point about things feeling a little bit deflated, feeling a little bit dull at the moment, it's because we popped that greenwashing bubble and we're seeing things for how they truly are, that we haven't really made that much progress through 30 years of voluntary sustainability. We're seeing the rise of these ultra-fast fashion brands and the environmental and climate consequences of those running rampant. And there's no longer this nice, happy smokescreen, this nice, happy green veneer on it to kid us that it's anything other than what it actually is. But it's so important to kind of knuckle down and soldier on through this period, because when we know how bad the situation is, we know what kind of solutions will work and what kind of solutions won't work. So maybe it makes sense in my head, and maybe I've spun it into a narrative that you know, helps me think that we're making progress. But that certainly gives me hope to kind of carry on, like, trucking on with it and not get too disheartened.
Yeah. No, I completely agree with you. I think that we just have to, like, you know, keep on going with what we have, because the ones that are greenwashing and not seeing any progress will kind of anyway fall off the bandwagon anyway. So I guess we just have to kind of stick with it and go through all of this. Lovely. Thank you so much, George, for having this conversation with us today. Can you tell our listeners where we can follow the work that EcoAge is doing? Is there anything to look forward to? All of that.
Yeah, absolutely. So EcoAge, we're on ecoage.com. The fossil fuel fashion campaign is fossilfuelfashioncampaign.com. and then I'm on LinkedIn mostly. That's where I mostly post about the work that we do. So George Harding Rolls on LinkedIn.
Thank you. Thank you, George, for having this conversation. I think it was extremely insightful and a conversation I've never had before, you know, diving deep into the issues that we're facing and the campaigns that EcoAge is doing and where we're headed. I enjoyed having this conversation because it felt a little bit more optimistic, and we weren't highlighting necessarily what has gone wrong and what we more about what we can do going forward. So I enjoyed this conversation, and I hope our listeners do as well.
Likewise, Nivi. Thank you so much for having me.
If you enjoyed this conversation, don't forget to subscribe to the EKV podcast, a space for discussion on living meaningful and fuller lives each day. The EKV podcast is a property edited and produced by the team at EKV.